My text is taken from Ephesians chapter 4, verses 1 through 6, and the text reads like this. As a prisoner of the Lord, I then urge you to live a life worthy of the calling that you have received. Be completely humble and gentle, be patient, bearing with one another in love, make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace. There's one body, one Spirit, as you were called, and one hope with as you were called to one hope when you were called, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all and through all and in all. This passage has special meaning for me, primarily because when I was a teenager and first beginning to pay attention in church and listen to the preacher, pay attention in class, start asking, what is all this Bible stuff? What's this Jesus story really all about? And began to get more interested in what the Bible's all about. I thought I should study the Bible more. I looked to my grandfather at the time I was living with my grandparents on a farm. My grandfather had a very limited education. I think he was just a third grade education. Had a hard time. He was semi-illiterate, had a hard time reading and writing and so forth. But he read his Bible every night, sometimes would fall asleep reading his Bible. And I looked up to him greatly as a man of example of what a Christian really ought to be. And so I asked him, what would be a good passage for me to memorize, the first passage I ever wanted to memorize. Tell him to memorize. And told me this passage here, Ephesians chapter 4, 1 through 6. Over the years, it's kind of amazing that he would point this passage out, because this has been such a vital passage throughout the course of our brotherhood and our history and so forth. But it talks quite a bit about how we need to be one, we all need to pull together as one. In recent weeks, we've been singing a song at the conclusion of our service about binding us together and being one. And so the idea of unity is one that we all are thinking quite a bit about. And I thought it would be a good passage to come back and revisit from time to time. But it's a very meaningful passage because of my grandfather's example, what he meant to me, and because this was the first passage I ever memorized, and it was the first passage I really spent a lot of time with thinking about, trying to talk about, and looking at what it means here. So I like to return to it occasionally just to remind myself of what is important for us as Christians to live the Christian life. It's always appropriate to remind ourselves of the common bond that we have together in Christ and the spirit of unity that is inherent in that relationship. I'm always amazed at the resistance to unity by people who claim to have a close relationship to Jesus. It's amazing to me how some people resist the idea of being unified or coming together. It is true that many people do not make the connection between what they believe about Jesus and how they feel about other people. I was at a meeting yesterday where we were talking. It was a men's breakfast in Milwaukee and so forth. And they were talking about the problem we have sometimes of connecting our devotion to Jesus with our feeling toward other people. And he spent a great deal of time talking about such stories as the rich man and Lazarus and the sheep and the goats and things of this nature. Where it's one thing to believe on Jesus, but it's quite another thing to look at your fellow person and think about something about them as well. Here was a rich man who thought he was a very righteous man. As far as we know, he probably went to a synagogue every Sabbath. He probably donated contributions and so forth. He probably tried to live his life as much as he possibly can. He lived a life of luxury and in their culture, a man who had a great deal of blessings in terms of life. They were considered to be favored by God. And yet at his very doorstep was laid a man full of sores who longed to eat the crumbs that fell from his table, Lazarus. And literally he steps over the man every day as he leaves his house and ignores the man completely. Eventually, of course, both men die. And in the story, the rich man wakes up in torment in a place called Hades, and he sees across the way, there's Lazarus sitting next to Abraham. And he then says something that sounds in his mind very humble. He says, please send Lazarus to dip his finger in some water and just cool my tongue one finger dip in water. Well, that's not going to cool your tongue at all, but he's asking what he thinks is a very humble thing. But he looks at Lazarus still as his servant. He still doesn't see Lazarus as someone who's equal with him or someone who deserves to be comforted as he had been comforted in his life. And Abraham says, I'm sorry. You had all the good things in your life, and now Lazarus, and so he starts bickering. Well, if he can't cross, send him back. He still thinks of Lazarus as his peon or Lazarus, someone. He doesn't quite connect the idea that what you think about other people matters to God. In the sheep and the goat stories, you have people on both sides. Some are sheep, some are goats. They have both, all of them believe, they believe in Jesus, all think they're serving Jesus. But one side is condemned because Jesus says, when I was hungry, you didn't feed me. When I was thirsty, you didn't give me anything to drink. And goes on and on about various things about it. And they say, well, when were you there? Well, when you didn't do it to the least of these, my people, that you don't consider very important, you didn't do it to me. So how you think about other people matters to God. That's very much a part of it. And that has to do with this sense of unity that we have here as well. Unity has to do with us being around other people. You're not the only one that matters. There are others that matter as well, too. So we need to learn how to work together or get along with one another. And this is a very important passage that talks about that. So I'd like to revisit the passage. I'll be looking primarily at the first part of the passage. I'm not going to worry about the one Lord, one body, and all the sorts of we understand that. But the first section, he says, I want you to live a life worthy of the calling. Now that makes us kind of ponder for a minute. Worthy of the calling. During the course of my ministry, there were times when people would refuse to eat communion because they didn't feel worthy enough. Somehow their sinful life or the things in their life would prohibit them from taking part of the communion because they weren't worthy enough. And they didn't seem to understand that taking in a worthy manner didn't mean that you were worthy, just taking in the manner, how you handled it was worthy. They were afraid of violating that command about taking in an unworthy manner. And sometimes we feel an awful lot like we think Isaiah felt in Isaiah 6. We were studying that in our adult Bible class this morning, Isaiah 6, where Isaiah goes to the temple and he sees the Lord, I mean, the grandeur of the Lord, and on his throne with all the seraphim and they're crying, holy, 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 and the train fills the whole room. And it's a glorious sight. It's beautiful to even read about it, much less imagine what it must have been like. And we would think he would say something to the effect, wow, this is amazing. Instead, he says, oh, no, I'm not worthy. I have a man of unclean lips. I live among the people of unclean lips. I'm not worthy. I'm not worthy. And how often we hear that idea, that concept, that we don't feel that somehow we're worthy. How dare God come to unworthy people and ask them to serve or ask them to become part of his service, ask them to become, as Peter would say, participants in the divine nature. How can we do that since we're so unworthy, we're so small, we're so tiny, we're so insignificant? What's the matter with God that he would look upon us this way? And yet there's a sense in which Jesus would consider us worthy, not so much because of our basic worth, as much as because of the attitude that we have. There's a passage in Matthew, let me get it right. Yeah, Matthew 10, 37, 38, where Jesus says these words. Listen to these words. He says, anyone who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves his son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who does not take up his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. So how is worth measured by Jesus? It really doesn't matter so much about what you think about your mother and your father. It has to do with how you think about them in terms of Jesus. Your devotion to Jesus is what makes you worthy. And if you're not going to be devoted to Jesus, well, then you become unworthy. That's how Jesus seemed to describe it. So how do we live a worthy life? It really comes down to putting Jesus first in our lives in every instance, not letting anything interfere with that. So many times we have a hard time getting over the idea of my way or the highway. Everything's got to be my way. I've got to be first. It's got to be me first. I've got to be everything. It's got to be the matters. And we miss the idea that Jesus is saying, no, you're not the only one that matters. Others matter too. And the call to the unselfish life is a call to the worthy life. And so he says, I want you to live a life worthy of the calling. Now, in the passage, he starts talking about some of the qualities of that worthy life, which I want to spend a little time talking about. It's vital to understand these characteristics of the worthy life. Among them, he mentions humility. What is humility? Well, obviously, it means lowliness. It's often used the word as part of that. The root is a word that has to do with organic things that fall to the earth and dissolve and become part of the earth itself. That's what humility is based on. The word humus is what we're talking about. But humility, it's the quality of lowering yourself down, making yourself not above others, but equal to others or the same as others. My favorite passage on humility is Romans chapter 12 and verse 3, where the word humility is not actually used, but it's described. There Paul says, Let no one think of himself more highly than he ought to think. Well, that sounds kind of like humility. But think of yourself with sober judgment. What does that mean? It means as you think of yourself, start asking yourself, well, what am I good at and what am I not good at? And try to be honest with yourself. Basically, humility comes down to being truly and brutally honest with yourself. What kind of a person am I? This is the kind of person that I am. And come to terms with what you really are. The old Shakespearean thing of know thyself, you know, be true to thyself. That's, it seems to kind of what we're getting at here. Honesty, humility really comes down to really truly understanding who you are. Sometimes we think of ourselves bigger than we actually are. And we sometimes we ask other people, who do you think you are? Where do you come off talking like that? How did you get to be so big? Only in your own mind you get to be that big. But in reality, we're not that big at all. We're just one among others. We're one among others that God has made. So when we begin to look at other people and see them as creatures made by God for God's purpose, for God's design, that God made them and that God loves them and that God sent his son to die for them just as much as he sent him to die for you. Then we begin to see people differently. We begin to understand people differently. And that's humility. Humility is part of the worthy life. You've got to be able to see others with love as God sees them with love in order to live a worthy life. He also mentions gentleness. There's probably no other basic Christian quality that is generally ignored or forgotten as much as this one here. What does it mean to be gentle? At one time, my parents had a real tiny chihuahua. It was an unusually small chihuahua. It was a classically small chihuahua. And they all just cooed over and loved it and petted it and made a big deal about it. And my granddaughter at the time, I think she was about 3 years old, she was used to being the center of all the attention. And she couldn't hardly stand it, but they were talking about this dog instead of talking about her. So I remember one time she reaches up and grabs the dog off the couch and throws it on the floor. And we all kind of reacted, oh, no, and I had to explain to my daughter, no, you got to be gentle. Well, she doesn't understand the word gentle. What do you mean to be? And it's really hard for me to kind of try to explain to a three-year-old how to be gentle. You have your strength, you have the power, you can do anything, but to be gentle is not use all the strength, is not use all the power to go easier with it than you would have gone. That's what gentleness is all about. When we think of gentleness with other people, it comes down to thinking about their needs, thinking about their wants, thinking about what their feelings are and so forth, and taking that into consideration. You understand that they're sensitive about certain things, so you don't push that matter. The trouble with family dynamics is that sometimes we get to learn each other's buttons, and we love to push the buttons just because it makes them jump, and just because it makes them kind of respond in a certain way, you know, and people get mad all the time. I remember counseling a guy when I was in Warsaw who got angry at everything. He had a hair trigger anger all the time. You get mad and you jump over the plane and act silly. I told him he sometimes acts like Donald Duck. I don't know if you remember Donald Duck when I was a kid. We watched Disney all the time. And Donald, he makes a funny little sound. I can't do it. It's like I used to. I used to be able to make that sound better. I can't do it now. But he make rah, rah, and everybody laugh how funny he is. Well, he would do that. You know, they'd hide his tools. He worked as a mechanic, or they put something out of place, and he'd jump around and make a squirm, and they'd laugh and laugh and laugh. And he got mad. He said, why are they doing that to me? I said, well, because you're acting like Donald Duck. And they enjoy that. He said, well, just don't get angry all the time about those things. You had to recognize they're trying to edge you on. And they're not trying to be gentle with you. Well, sometimes you got to stop you know, the things that you're so sensitive about, and allow things to kind of just roll on. Don't let them push your buttons is what it comes down to. Gentleness has to do with understanding what the other person's buttons are, and not pushing them, not going out of your way to aggravate someone because you have fun doing that. Gentleness has to do with consideration. It's an extension of loving for one another. That's what gentleness is really all about. Hey, another word for gentleness would be the word meekness. We don't really understand meekness very well. We think meekness, because it sounds like weakness, must be the same thing as weakness, but it's not. Meekness is basically a word that relates to, in the Greek it was akin to the word of a bit they put in the horse's mouth, where you could control the horse, but you didn't break the spirit of the horse. The horse had the power and the force to do what it needed to do, but you could control that. That's what meekness is all about. It's sort of a controlled strength, and that's what gentleness really is, too. The next thing has to do with patience. Patience is the ability to wait. Now, we Americans don't like to wait, but we all have to wait. from time to time. Sometimes you've got to get into a line, you've got to wait. And sometimes you're waiting in a line, you see the other line's going faster, so you try to switch lines, and then they got to wait there because then so the line you're in goes faster. You know, we hate waiting, but waiting is what patience is really all about. Recognize that something's going to take place eventually, and it just doesn't happen right now. So it's a matter of putting your time and waiting for it and allowing things to take place. It's a practical application of unselfishness. You must put your desires aside to wait on someone else or to wait for something else. And so in the Christian life, there's a great deal of patience. Sometimes you have patience with one another. And then you have the forbearing spirit. Another word for that is tolerance. And we hear an awful lot about tolerance today. Of course, there's a tongue-in-cheek because politically, some people claim to be tolerant, but they're not really tolerant. But to be truly tolerant is to understand that you've got to put up with an awful lot of things that they go on. There are a lot of differences between us, and sometimes these differences cause friction. And we need to overlook the tendency to become intolerant of one another just because we need to hold ourselves together. So sometimes you've got to put up with people that do things or say things that you find offensive, or sometimes you might even find them stupid, but you got to keep you're tolerant. You put up with these sorts of things because we are one, we're brethren, we're together, and so forth. So, the most difficult people I've ever had to work with in the course of my life are smart people who know they're smart because they've been told they're smart all their life, and so they start believing that they're smart. And when they believe they're smart, they start looking at everyone else as being not as smart as they are. And so they try to remind everyone that they're not as smart as they are. You understand? And it really rubs people the wrong way. You don't want to be always telling you that they're smarter than you are. You may recognize it yourself. You may admit it yourself. But you don't like them trying to rub your nose in it. You know, that's where. So sometimes it's kind of hard for us to be forbearing when putting up with these idiosyncrasies of these things people do about themselves. That makes it difficult. And then he says this attitude of work toward keeping the unity of the Spirit in the context of peace. It doesn't work in the context of war. It only works in the context of peace. It's something we must be willing to work at and to work hard at, to recognize that sometimes we have to work very hard to try to maintain a spirit of unity because we're working together, sometimes because they are so different. If we can incorporate these qualities, our characteristics, into our lives, we'll be more willing to have to living lives that are worthy of a calling. And now I want to kind of switch to something I've always kind of toyed with, and that's images of unity. One of the most powerful images of unity that I recall from the Old Testament, I remember this was pointed out to me by an old friend of mine, was the Tower of Babel. Tower of Babel, how is that a story of unity? Well, let me read the story to you. In Genesis 11, it reads, "Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. And as men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. And they said to each other, 'Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly. And they used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. And then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth." But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower that the men were building. And the Lord said," now listen to what the Lord said, "if as one people, speaking the same language, they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them." See, there's a power of unity right there. They're together. They have one language. They're working together. Nothing is impossible for them. "Come, let us go down and continue and confuse your language so they will not understand each other." So in this particular story, the solution to the problem was that God disrupted their communications ability. He changed their language so they couldn't talk to one another. One of the key elements of unity is the ability to communicate with each other and to talk to each other about what's going on, what needs to be done. And that's a very important point. The key to unity was the communication. God disrupted their unity by destroying their communication. When they can no longer understand each other, they dropped their work and they drifted apart. And the lesson's a very powerful one today because most of the time when unity fails, it's due to a breakdown in communication. A second image of unity we find in the New Testament is in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. Beginning in verse 12, he writes, "The body is a unit. Though it is made up of many parts, and though its parts are many, they form our body, one body. So it is with Christ. For we were all baptized with one spirit into one body, whether Jews or Greek, slaves or free, for we were all given the one spirit to drink. Now the body is not made up of one part, but of many. If the foot should say, because I'm not a hand, I don't belong to the body, it would not be for that reason cease to be a part of the body. And if the ear should say, because I'm not an eye, I do not belong to the body, it should not be for that reason cease to be a part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, what would the sense be of hearing be? If the whole body were an ear, what would the sense of smell be? But in fact, God has arranged the parts of the body, every one of them, just as he wanted them to be. If they were all one part, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts but one body. He makes a pretty good point here, a simple point, it's kind of an obvious point. All of us together make up a body, the body of Christ. We serve separate or different functions. Some of us are good at doing one thing, some of us are good at doing another thing. We all can't do the same things. We all do different things that makes up part of what the body is all around. Some of us have the function of a hand, which makes us very useful. Others of us may have the function of, he says, of an ear or a nose or, you know, whatever the function you find, you need to do the best you can at whatever God has given you to do. And don't feel bad because I'm not as good as someone else. I'm not able to teach, I'm not able to sing, I'm not able to preach, whatever other things they do in church, I'm not able to do it because someone else is doing it better than I am. So what? Do the best you can do with what you're doing. And that makes you make a contribution as you're part of the body. So the body all works together in doing these different things. And it's amazing because when he takes the image of the body, when one part of the body hurts, he mentions other places, the whole body hurts. Now you can illustrate this yourself. Have you ever tried to nail a nail with a hammer and you miss, and sometimes you hit the thumb or hit your finger? Oh, what happens then? Well, you react somehow to it. Sometimes you may shake your finger, but most of the time you stick it in your mouth, you suck it, you kiss it, and you comfort it. You're trying to comfort that little piece that's hurt. Oh, and every part of you wants to comfort the piece that's hurt because the whole body hurts because that one little thing hurting there. You know, and sometimes you wrap it, and sometimes you do all kinds of trying to nurse it to bring it back to health because you love that little part of your body. You may have not even thought about the little part of your body until you hurt it, but now suddenly you think about it an awful lot because it's been hurt. Well, that's the way the body works. The body cares about it. If you stub your toe, well, you don't just cut your toe off. You take care of that toe. You nurse it. You make some protection for it. That's the way that we do with the body. The body is an important part, and we love all parts of our body. On the other hand, and this kind of illustrates sometimes something we call excommunication. Have you ever chewed on your nails, fingernail? You get it all broken off in your mouth. Then what do you do with it? Spit it out. It's not a part of the body no more. I don't want it no more. It has nothing to do with me. I don't have, you know, I excommunicate that, spew it from me because it's not part of it. But once it's connected to the body, chew on it, I nurse it, I care about it. It's a very important part of it. So the body matters to us. Every part of the body matters to us. And when a part is cut off from that body, it no longer matters too much to us. We have to go on without it. The last image, I think, he says, he talks about, let me get my passage right here. Oh, 2 Corinthians, that's what it is, 2 Corinthians, that's what it is. That's a real familiar passage, 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Let me see, let me get the exact verses here. 14 and 15, 2 Corinthians 6, verses 14 and 15. Do not be yoked together with an unbeliever. What do righteousness have? Come on, read it right. For what do righteousness and wickedness have in common? Or what fellowship does light have with darkness? What harmony is there between Christ and Belial? What does a believer have in common with an unbeliever? What agreement is there between the temple of God and idols and so forth? So we have this idea of a yoke. When I lived on the farm with my grandfather, he plowed fields with a horse. He had one horse, but he had to borrow a neighbor's horse. But the two horses together, and he would plow the field with the horses and so forth. And so the interesting lessons you learned about just following the horses and watching the horses pull and so forth. But they would have these devices that connected them together, which we call yokes. All right. Now with horses, it's a little bit different than with oxen, but that the concept is one where you get the animals together, and when they begin to pull together, it doesn't matter whether the horses like each other, it has nothing to do with it. They have a common goal in mind, that is to pull whatever the load is, and as they pull the load, they're working together in conjunction with each other. So being yoked together brings them together to do their work together. Somehow the nature of the work brings unity. And I've noticed that in church. Sometimes you get to working with someone. You may not know them. You may not care about them. You may not even like them. But if together we're going to paint this wall, or we're going to nail these boards together, or we're going to build you, we're going to make something, we're going to repair the roof. Whatever we're doing, we're working together. And as we're working together, because we have the same goal in mind, we find some kind of sense of bonding with one another. There's a sense that brings us together because the work unites us itself. So the image of the yoke is a powerful image because it talks about the sense of being brought together to work hard together to accomplish something, whether we're pulling something or pushing something. So that's what a yoke does. So don't be yoked with unbelievers because you got nothing in common with them. So what you believe does matter, and that's an important part of it. But he says that this image of unity is a powerful one because we are bound together. In our song, singing about bind us together with love, that's part of it. But yokes us together, the sense of working together for the cause of the goal we're trying to accomplish. What are we trying to accomplish? What's our purpose? What's our goal in mind? Well, we're working toward a certain goal is what we're doing. And as long as we work together, we're yoking together, and so we're able to kind of bring this together. And that brings a sense of unity about us as well. So it's a very powerful idea, very powerful passage. And he ends by talking about the oneness of everything. One Lord, one body, one spirit, all that sort of stuff. We understand that. That's very beautiful. That's very meaningful to us. But this idea that first of all, it depends upon living a life worthy of the calling. When I taught ladies' Bible class, when I first started preaching, only men could teach ladies' Bible class. That didn't make sense to me. But eventually, we find that a woman could actually teach a ladies' Bible class. But at the time, I had to teach ladies' Bible class. And I remember the ladies would talk about things. And one day, they start talking about when they were girls growing up. They'd hear they'd be out in the summertime playing and everything. And then as it starts getting dark, they'd hear their mothers call Janie, Susie, Mary. You know, they call and the children come in because the mothers call them. And the one was talking. She said, "You know, her name was Gloria." She said, "I never heard my mother call my name." She said, "I only went in because there was no one else to play with, because all the kids left, and I had to go in by myself." I remember thinking, how sad a commentary on a person's life. You never got your calling by your mother. They didn't call your name. And there's a sense of Christianity where we have a calling. We've been called to something. I like the passage in 1 Peter says we've been called it's not there. It'll come there probably halfway home. And but you have certain callings. You know, we've been called out of darkness into light. We've been called to peace sometimes. We've been called to love, called to grace, all the things has to do with what we're called to. This is a calling you've received from God. It's not quite like sometimes sometimes elevate preachers, well, what's your calling? Well, frankly, truthfully, they got these stories. They don't really have much of it. You don't really have a voice in the night saying, "Roy, oh, you preach." No, you don't get something like that at all. You interpret little suggestive things that happen in your life. Say, "Well, maybe that's my calling." You don't really know what your calling is. But we all have a calling from God. And when we heard the gospel and respond to the gospel, we've been called out of the darkness, called out of the way of life we were in. We've been called out of the corruption of the world, Peter would use in 2 Peter chapter 1, called out of the corruption of the world. And it's a terrible thing to become re-entangled in that corruption. So live up to your calling is what Paul is saying here. Live a life worthy of the calling. And that means putting Christ first, putting Jesus first above all things. And if we can do that and we do that together with one, if we all have that calling in our minds, we will be yoked together. We will be a body together. We will be able to build together as they built with the Tower of Babel. We will be one, and there will be a sense of unity about us that the world will be amazed at. Jesus prayed in John 17 that we might be one as he and the Father are one, that the world may know that we're his disciples. It's a powerful statement. We can just be together and show love to you and show a sense of respect and consideration toward one another. So as we sing our song at the end of our service today, let's contemplate the meaning of being bound together. Bind us together, Lord, we pray in the song. let us be bound by our love, by our devotion to Jesus Christ, and by our sense of commitment to God together